The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platform. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Today is Tuesday. It is 10:06 a.m. here in London, making it 11:06 a.m. in Cape Town, where my good friend Dr. Peter Hammond is. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
I'm with you, yes. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Peter. And the topic Peter has got for us today is the real story behind the assassination of Lawrence of Arabia. So where would you like to start us off with this topic today, Peter?
Well, Andrew, I'm sure many of our listeners have seen the famous film, the 1962 Lawrence of Arabia, absolutely spectacular, one of the most impressive films ever made on one of the most amazing men of the 20th century. Thomas Edward Lawrence, better known as Lawrence of Arabia, was a Briton who wrote a stupendous book, Seven Pillars of Wisdom. All of that book was suppressed for many years after his death because it was too critical of the British government. He's an amazing man, as Thomas Edward Lawrence, and he died in a motorbike accident, according to the common narrative out there. But there's so many questions about this motorbike accident. And in fact, there are those who are convinced in the intelligence community that T.E. Lawrence, or Lawrence of Arabia, was the first of the assassinations, which was followed by so many other assassinations, often seen as vehicle accidents, in order to get rid of people who were embarrassing for the powers that be. And he was a threat to the New World Order, or he's certainly perceived as a threat to New World Order. Now, if you've seen the film, Lawrence of Arabia, you'll see how it begins with him, Lawrence, riding off on his motorbike and without a helmet, which is very significant. It was his head injuries, which was blamed for the motorbike accident because he wasn't wearing a helmet, that led to legislation that later made motorbike helmets required for motorbikers, which probably has saved my life, to be fair, because I've come off my motorbike a few times, and each time my helmet has been horribly scarred, making me think that helmet was a good investment. In fact, as a young motorbiker, just telling you how money has changed. My first motorbike I bought brand new out of the shop window for 1,000 Rand. Now, the Rand used to be stronger than the British pound. It used to be stronger than the American dollar. The South African Rand was one of the strongest currencies in the world. Right now, the South African Rand is something like 25 to the British pound and 19 to the US dollar. So our money's been debased since the country was betrayed in the hands of the African National Congress, but that's another story. Just talking about motorbikes and helmets, I was standing at the shop wanting to buy a helmet, and there was a sign on the a helmet rack saying, if you have a 10 Rand head, buy a 10 Rand helmet. Now, you can actually buy helmets for 10 Rand, just showing you how our money has changed. I mean, these days would be thousands of rands for a good helmet. Sorry to say, that's how money's been debased. But I decided to invest in the most expensive helmet there, which was a 100 Rand helmet. Who knows what that would cost today? Considering I bought my motorbike for 1,000 Rand, you can imagine, okay, we're now talking about 1981 money, but still. I know that my helmet saved my life. Well, T.E. Lawrence didn't have a helmet on his motorbike, and he suffered head injuries that led to him dying within the week after that accident. So it was on the 13th of May in 1935 that T.E. Lawrence, which at that stage is known as T.E. Shaw, he actually changed his name because he abhorred the publicity and he had been turned into a celebrity. He was probably one of the first great celebrities of the 20th century. And they had light shows, films of different sorts on Lawrence of Arabia, and he had become such an epic national hero. There were so many disastrous things that happened in the First World War, and so many people died senselessly in the trenches in Flanders and in Belgium. And because of the tremendous loss of life with very little to show for it and endless defeats on the Western Front, that the British government looked around for some distractions and inspirations that could help somehow justify the tremendous expenses people are pouring into this war. And the sideshow, as they called it, of the war against the Ottoman Empire and the particularly spectacular role played by T.E. Lawrence made him an ideal distraction, much like Dr. David Livingston was used in his day to distract people from the horrors of the Crimean War and the failures of the British government. They, in many ways, boosted the missionary David Livingston in order to distract people from the mistakes, chaos, and shambles like the Chartered Light Brigade and the pointless losses in the war, the Crimean War, which was going on in the 1850s. Well, so Lawrence was used as a distraction for the public during the First World War. He lost two brothers on the Western Front, by the way. And he hated the war very much, and it cost a lot. And he came out of the war with post-traumatic stress syndrome. Not that anyone knew the name at the time. They would have just called it shell shock. And so he was traumatized by the war, very severely traumatized. But he was more traumatized by the British government's deceit and treachery towards the Arab allies, because Lawrence was so embarrassed that everything he had promised the Arab leaders, like Sheikh or Emir Faisal, later became King Faisal, that he had promised the Arabs independence and freedom, and if they would help fight against the Ottoman Turkish Empire, which was an enemy of Great Britain during the First World War. And of course, the British, the Australians and New Zealanders had lost vast amounts of people fighting against the Turks in the attempts to breach the Bosphorus. And so the Dardanelles attempt, which was a catastrophe, and the Gallipoli landings, where so many Anzac troops, Australians and New Zealanders, got pointlessly thrown in sacrificial frontal assaults, which ended up with massive losses. And to this day, Australia and New Zealand celebrate or commemorate, rather, Anzac Day, and they commemorate in particular with deep mourning how many of their sons they lost in the Gallipoli landings, which were ill thought out and catastrophically impossible. So again, they needed a distraction from these defeats, which was a Winston Churchill special. Winston Churchill then was First Lord of the Admiralty, and he got this idea in his head that they could win the war, the First World War, by knocking Turkey out of the war, and they were going to do it by running the Royal Navy through the Bosphorus, which is a narrow strait, and there's forts on both sides with heavy guns, and the Turks were going to oppose any attempt of the Royal Navy to go through the Bosphorus into the Black Sea. And the whole goal was to help the ally Russia and to knock Turkey out of the war. And of course, one of the dictums of Admiral Lord Nelson was ships do not fight forts. Of course, forts have tremendous advantages over ships. Ships are much more fragile than forts on land, and the guns on land can be much, much bigger caliber with much greater range than guns on ships. And so ships do not fight forts. And here, First Lord Admiralty Winston Churchill sent in the Royal Navy to fight forts. And of course, they lost. They lost battleships, they lost destroyers, they lost cruisers. A tremendous loss of ships for the Royal Navy. I think they lost even more ships in the attempt to force the Dardanelles Then they lost in the biggest sea battle of the First World War, the Battle of Jutland. And so extraordinary and catastrophic things being done. And so there needed to be distractions. And here was an amazing man, T.E. Lawrence, who was a junior officer in the Arab Bureau in Cairo. And he was dealing with maps and things like this. And in fact, Lawrence was an archaeologist who had learned Arabic fluently. He'd become enchanted with Arab culture. And he had already in 1912 been involved in covert operations doing archaeology in the Negev Desert. And it was a cover for military survey of the Negev Desert. So he was already working effectively as a spy, despite his cover of being an archaeologist. And he was assigned to Arab Bureau, and he is in Cairo when the First World War erupted in 1914. And then he was tasked to assist with Sheikh Faisal, the son of Hussein bin Ali, the Sheikh Sharif of Mecca. And of course, Faisal was an Arab nationalist, but so was Lawrence. And they made a tremendous partnership. In fact, they really bonded. And for some reason, the Sheikh or Emir Faisal really came to trust Lawrence, and Lawrence came to highly respect not only Emir Faisal, but the whole Arab nation and Arab movement and Arab nationalism. And this succeeded making the Arab revolt against the Turks a resounding success. And it was, the British called it a sideshow of a sideshow, but it was a successful sideshow, and it was glamorous. And because an American journalist came out and filmed Lawrence of Arabia, and he basically made him known as that name in heroic actions of, for example, ambushing trains and derailing Turkish trains and leading revolts and actions. And most spectacularly, when Lawrence and Sheikh Faisal entered into Damascus and seized Damascus, which was the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world, dating back many thousands of years, and the heart of Arab nationalism and one of the most strategic and important cities in the Middle East. And so when they took Damascus, this was seen as one of the most spectacular victories of the war. And after the defeats in the Western Front trenches and the huge amounts of chaos, like with the Battle of the Somme, where something in the region of a million men on the Allied side died and gained less than 4 kilometers of territory, which they lost very soon thereafter. And the hard won and hard lost defeats really on the Western Front in the First World War. But there were these amazing victories, glamorous victories in the land of the Bible, in these Middle Eastern lands. And Lawrence of Arabia, a British junior officer, then only a lieutenant, later he ended the war as a lieutenant colonel, but he was achieving spectacular things. And so he got world famous, he got celebrity status, and T.E. Lawrence was extremely embarrassed by how the war ended and how the Arabs that he had promised freedom, and they had been fighting for freedom from the Ottoman Turks. And at the end of the war, at the Versailles Treaty, they saw their lands parceled up between the French, who had had nothing to do with the war in the Ottoman Empire, who had done nothing to help win these battles. But the French were claiming a whole lot of territory like Syria, just by virtue of the fact that they were allies of the British. And here, the British government had made promises to Sheikh Faisal of freedom for the Arab nationalists to establish their own countries. And now suddenly these countries are all being handed over either to the French or to the British Empire. And the British Empire got Iraq and Jordan, for example, whereas the French got Syria. And so dividing up the Ottoman Empire and betraying the people for whom they'd actually requested their help made Lawrence feel so sickened, so embarrassed, that when he is brought before the King of England, King George V, to receive a knighthood and other awards, he refused them by way of protest about how the British government had treacherously mistreated their allies, the Arab allies, and how they had gone back on their word. And at the heart of this was this Sykes-Picot agreement, where France and Britain agreed to divide up the Ottoman Empire's territories between France and Britain, with Britain getting the oil-rich Iraq and the French getting the very strategic Syria. And so this Sykes-Picot agreement violated so much of what Britain had promised the Arabs if they would lead a revolt against the Turks and draw away Turkish attention from British goals. And not only that, but then the Balfour Declaration, where it came out that in 1917, Lord Balfour, the British Foreign Office, had promised the Zionists in America, we will give you Palestine to make a Jewish state in the Middle East if you bring America in on a war. And so the Balfour Declaration, which was secret, at least as far as Lawrence was concerned, and the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which went right against everything promised to the Arabs, when his Arab friends and allies came to hear of these agreements at the Versailles Treaty, they were shocked, they were outraged, and poor Lawrence felt completely humiliated to the extent that he not only refused all the honors and even knighthood from the British king, and he, in fact, even changed his name. And he then enlisted first under the name John Hume Ross in the Royal Air Force as a mechanic. So he was a lieutenant colonel in the British Army, but he retired to private life. And then he literally renamed himself John Hume Ross and later as T.E. Shaw. And he first enlisted in the Royal Air Force. And interestingly, when he attempted to join the Royal Air Force, the author of Biggles, who is W.E. Smith, a very well-known boys like me who were reading the Biggles books, all Air Force related, he was the recruiter, and he refused Lawrence because, at that stage, his name then was Shaw, and he refused him when he tried to join the Royal Air Force because he discerned that he was giving false documents and a false name. And interesting that later some big name came through, some high up ordered them to recruit him anyway, to put him in the Air Force, because it was determined by the powers that be, this man's a loose cannon, he's dangerous, better to have him as a private in the Air Force where he's under the Official Secrets Act, we can control him, than to have him wandering around alone. So he was only in the Air Force a very short time, then he later joined the Tank Corps, and then he joined the Royal Air Force again. And there were all kinds of accusations when he was in the Royal Air Force that he was involved in espionage. At one point, Lawrence, who was only a private from this point on, and as a mechanic, he was posted to India near the Afghanistan border. And when an outbreak of rebellion broke out in Afghanistan, it was assumed in the British Parliament that somehow Lawrence was involved. And so it was discussed on the floor of the House of Commons about the security breach, and the Royal Air Force was so embarrassed that this Arab nationalist, Lawrence of Arabia, was in the Royal Air Force close to the border of Afghanistan. Maybe it had something to do with the nationalist Afghan revolt against the Brits. So he actually got recalled, and as a result, he was in and out of the Royal Air Force with these controversies. And the British government and said he's obviously a spy, but the question is, where's his loyalties and to whom does he have allegiance? Because it was pointed out that Lawrence had sworn allegiance to the British king, King George V, but he had also sworn allegiance to King Faisal. And he was considered as a loose cannon, and therefore they wanted to watch him. And he was definitely being watched. His correspondence was being intercepted. And T.E. Lawrence was considered to be a threat to the establishment. He had publicly gone to the media with details of how British government's solemn declarations and promises made to the Arabs in order for the Arab revolt to succeed had been violated, and the British had gone back on their word and had betrayed their Arab allies. And the Versailles Treaty was a disgrace and a disaster and a catastrophe, and that the whole of the Middle East would be a powder keg and there would be more and more wars. And especially he was opposed to the idea of putting a Jewish nation in the Middle East, which would be a continual source of discontent, and there would be more and more wars as a result, and that the very quiet, sleepy backwater of the Middle East was going to turn to be central in the world's wars. And he became very much strong, not that he ever was a pacifist in the sense that he wouldn't believe in defense, but he became anti-war. And he was joining different anti-war movements and groups and very vocal in opposing the inevitable drift into the Second World War. He recognized, after being at the Versailles Treaty, that this Versailles Treaty was counterproductive and disastrous. It was so vindictive, it was so punitive, it was going to bring about a Second World War, because everything that they had stolen from Germany would have to be taken back. Germany, after being pushed down, bankrupted, crushed, was going to rise again, and it would exact a revenge against those in France and Britain who had so vindictively sought to break them down and destroy the economy and all the rest of it. So there was Lawrence minding his own business, basically, but getting increasingly concerned about Europe getting back involved in the war and the war lobby in Britain, that he, back in May the 13th, 1935, set out to ride his motorcycle near Clouds Hill, his little cottage, which didn't even have plumbing, close to Warham. Now, he had made a lot of money from his Seven Pillars of Wisdom book, which was a spectacular runaway success. But all that money went into a trust to help people who were either handicapped, crippled because of the First World War. He had the Lawrence of Arabia Trust, which was caring for orphans who'd lost people in the war, and soldiers who weren't being cared for by the government, who should have been. And so he was so poverty-stricken because he'd given away the vast amounts of royalties his books had earned in charities. So he had a home that didn't even have a toilet. It didn't even have plumbing. His bathroom needed to have buckets of water carried in order to operate. So he's living in a very simple, primitive cottage close to Warham. And the official version in the story is he was on his motorbike, came to a dip in the road, and as he rose up out of the rise, he found himself about to hit two boys on bicycles. And swerving, he lost control, was flipped over the handlebars of his motorcycle, and he sustained a mortal head wound, but died 6 days later, the 19th of May, 1935. Interestingly, the film that you see, the scene that Lawrence of Arabia film starts with, is completely false, but because people have seen it so well portrayed on the screen, they assume that the Lawrence of Arabia film is the gospel truth, that he came up over a rise and he sees two boys on bicycles coming towards him, and he swerves to avoid them, loses control, and crashes. In fact, the boys on the bicycles were going the same direction as him, and he was trying to pass them, but a black car came past and clipped him. And in fact, this is pretty much proven by the forensics. And so he couldn't avoid the boys on the bicycles because of this black car that came and hit him which caused him to lose control, crash into one of the boys on the bicycle, and fall head over heels over his handlebars and fall against one of the only trees in the road. Now, in the movie, there's lots and lots of trees lining the road, but in fact, there's only about three trees on the whole road at that time. An inquest was held at Bovington Camp. It was a tank corps camp where he was based at that stage. He is buried in the local churchyard the same day as the inquest was held. But there was all sorts of things that were a problem. The first thing is, he was under surveillance by the British Secret Service. When the accident happened, the Secret Service were already at the hospital. They put a total lockdown on all information going out about the accident. In fact, the British public didn't hear about the accident at all. They first heard about the accident 6 days later when Lawrence of Arabia died. Then finally they were allowed to announce that there'd been an accident 6 days earlier. But there were D-notices that went out, immediately stopping any reporting on this accident, and only when he died did the story come out. So why were the Secret Service running the hospital closing down the hospital, lockdown. The military base at Bovington Camp was put on a lockdown immediately, no information allowed out. And interestingly, although there were three eyewitnesses from the camp standing there who witnessed the accident, only one was called upon, Corporal Catchpole, and he gave a testimony. He's a Private Catchpole. Private Catchpole gave the testimony, but the other two eyewitnesses were never called. And when the boys were called, they had a very wooden, rehearsed presentation that was so a word perfect. It was like they'd learned their lines for a school play, and they were not cross-examined. And the boys denied that there'd been a black car. Now, Private Catchpole mentioned this black car that came past at the same time and then disappeared. No one else had ever seen it. It didn't go through the town. It was not seen at Bovington. It wasn't seen at Warham. And so, interestingly enough, the inquest just didn't want to mention it, but called back Catchpole to question him, did he really see a black car? Could he have been mistaken? No, he is not mistaken. He's adamant. And the two boys said there was no other car, there's no other vehicle on the road, even though there were others who had seen it, but two others weren't called. More significantly, the mechanic who was asked to examine the motorbike was not allowed to testify. He just was asked to give a written statement that there was nothing wrong with the motorbike, that the motorbike was not deficient. He noticed that a front brake had snapped, but of course that would have been because T. Lawrence would have pulled hard on the front brake, and the front brakes were known to sometimes snap because of the exertion he would have put for an emergency stop. The back brake would have been more resilient and could handle it easier. But he also had noted that there was black paint on the sides of the tank and on the sides of the handlebars and the mirror, and that plainly some vehicle had clipped or passed by and hit the motorbike. And this was left out of the inquest, and the mechanic who observed all these things was not called to testify. And the whole thing was rushed up and wrapped up in the morning. And the inquest should have adjourned to find this mysterious black car. And it seems very likely that that car was driven by some MI5 people who were using a vehicle accident as a cover for an assassination. And the first question is, who would want to kill T.E. Lawrence? Well, actually, T.E. Lawrence had lots and lots of enemies. I mean, just for starters, the Arabs would have been feeling betrayed. He's the one who was used by the British government to promise them freedom, nationhood, independence. And, of course, the Allies betrayed him. Now, I don't think the Arabs would have targeted him because he is their friend, and he was a long-standing friend, and he was more outraged than even they were by the duplicity of the politicians and the treachery of the British Foreign Office. But obviously they were angry about the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the Balfour Declaration. But I don't think many Arab leaders would have blamed T. Lawrence for those things. They probably recognized he was as much a victim as they were of this duplicity. But there were the Zionist Jews who regarded Lawrence as a threat and as a friend to the Arab nationalists. And at that point, many were deeply concerned about the potential of Lawrence in 1935 to be supporting the Arabs against what the British government was doing in helping the Zionists resettle the area. There were clashes taking place. Of great significance is, in 1914, the Royal Navy changed its fuel for all the ships from coal to oil. And that was an important shift. And from that point, oil became seriously important, and therefore Arabia and Iraq and Kuwait became extremely important, significant allies and markets for the British. And so the shift of the Royal Navy from coal to oil marked an important distinction. And here was T. Lawrence as a plain friend of the Arabs and a plain friend of Arab nationalism, and as a vocal opponent of the State of Israel being set up and of the Versailles Treaty and the way how Winston Churchill redrew the map for the Middle East and all of that. Quite aside from the fact that the poor Kurds had been left without a country and Kurdistan was just divided up between the Ottoman Turks, between Iraq and between Iran, and with some Kurds also ending up in Syria, which was then placed under French anyway. So there were a lot of things that T. Lawrence had to complain about, that he was angry about. But there was another thing. He was joining with peace parties in Europe and in Britain, and this included the British Union of Fascists, so-called. The Sir Oswald Molesley, leading of the British Union of Fascists, or the Black Shirts, were leading the whole charge against a slide back into war. They were very strong advocates for peace. They were very much, many of them had been veterans of the First World War and were opposed to going back into a war against Germany, and that Britain must stop their attempts to always fight against whoever's the biggest power in Europe, and that this divide and conquer strategy had to end, and we can't have another repeat of the disastrous First World War and losing a whole generation. Now, at this moment, the political leanings of T.E. Lawrence, or as he's then known, T.E. Shaw, was very much for the peace lobby, but he is also a good friend of the Hawthornden Prize winner, Henry Williamson. And Henry Williamson was, while not a member, he is a supporter of the British Union of Fascists, the Black Shirts, and he was facilitating a meeting between Lawrence and Adolf Hitler, the new chancellor in Germany. And the idea that this celebrity, this national hero, Lawrence of Arabia, might meet with the chancellor of Germany, Adolf Hitler, to speak about how to avoid a new war and the need for peace between especially Britain and Germany. And many veterans of the First World War in Britain abhorred the idea of another war in Europe. And so Molesley and Williamson were getting support. And if a celebrity figure, a hero like Lawrence of Arabia, threw in the lot with him, it would have been catastrophic for the war lobby. In fact, when the Duke of Windsor, the previous British king who had abdicated, met with Adolf Hitler, it was slapped to the D notice, and the British people only learned about that meeting 70 years later. It was so covered because it was seen as such an embarrassment to have a British royal having met with Adolf Hitler, and in a very positive way, and speaking well of what they saw in Germany. And so the Duke of Windsor's meeting was seen as such a catastrophe. They literally censored that information from the British public for 70 years. Well, a man like Lawrence of Arabia, who got such media attention, he would have been a big embarrassment. And so he has this vehicle accident. And it was much like Princess Diana's vehicle accident back in 1987, when people went quite berserk about that. And maybe they even had the same kind of origins and causes. But a national celebrity like Lawrence in 1935 is akin to the celebrity vehicle accident of Princess Diana back in the 1980s and 1990s. And so here you had, some people have even said, if Lawrence of Arabia had met with Adolf Hitler, it could have changed the whole course of the 20th century history. It might have prevented the war entirely. It would have been such a boost for the peace lobby. And so there were people within Britain who saw Lawrence is a threat. He's a traitor. They used that word. He's a traitor. He's a threat. He's on the Arab side. He's against the idea of establishing the state of Israel. He's so popular amongst the people. He's seen as one of the greatest heroes of all time. And he would have boosted Molesley's movements and the movement against drift into war. He would have reinforced the peace movements dramatically. And so MI5 might have seriously been involved in this, and they could have easily organized this. This car that came past and clipped his motorbike at a key time caused the accident, and the driver never stopped. The vehicle never came back. The driver of the vehicle never reported anything. This was some kind of black bag job. And so what we are seeing here is a key figure of the 20th century assassinated. And this fits into so many other great assassinations you think of, whether it's President John F. Kennedy, whether you're thinking of the other assassinations of the 20th century, such as the Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria, which had such catastrophic events and results, we would think that the assassination, the organized vehicle accident for T.E. Lawrence, was one of those things that probably changed the direction of history. And you can see the oil people would have had a reason for this. The British Foreign Office, probably. He was seen as a threat to the New World Order, the globalists, and what they had in mind, which, of course, led to not only the Second World War, but then the United Nations and globalism and so many of the wars that have followed from the Cold War and so on. And so there's actually a film out on was Lawrence of Arabia murdered, and well worth seeing. I think they make a very strong case. I think they've got a very effective presentation there. Many witnesses, people who knew him, and experts testifying of how important he was and how much of a threat he is perceived by the establishment. There's also interesting, we've all probably seen Lawrence of Arabia, but there's another film out that came called Dangerous Man, Lawrence After Arabia, which is a 1990 film, well worth seeing too, which shows how frustrated he was at the duplicity and treachery of the British Foreign Office and the negotiators at the Versailles Treaty in Paris. And that film takes you further into the conflict between Lawrence and the government of Great Britain, who, of course, were very much committed to the Balfour Declaration, very much committed to the Zionist state of Israel being established, and the oil lobby's requirements and how to control the Arabs and divide up the control between the French and the British. So I think the Dangerous Man, Lawrence After Arabia, is well worth seeing film too. Was Lawrence of Arabia murdered? Is a good documentary to see. And I think he's an amazing person, an extraordinary person as an archaeologist, as an author, as a diplomat, and as one of the key leaders of the Arab revolt, which led to Sinai, the Palestine campaign, defeat of the Ottoman Empire, the seizing of Damascus. He played a pivotal role in those events, and an extraordinary person. Winston Churchill said he's one of the most amazing men in all of history, and as though he came from another planet. In fact, the praises of Winston Churchill is quite amazing. Even though Churchill put himself as a friend of Lawrence, he might have had a hand in getting rid of Lawrence as well, because Lawrence was a key critic of not only how he redrew the maps of the Middle East, which guaranteed many wars, but the way how he was playing a key role in leading Britain back into war with Germany, which, of course, Lawrence thought was going to be catastrophic, not only for Europe, but for Britain. And so it has proved to be. So back to you, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Peter. Yes, it's a very interesting story, and I know that the film is tremendously popular. I'm pleased that you mentioned the 1990 film that sort of takes us through the events after Lawrence of Arabia, because I'm sure that many people that are familiar with that film wouldn't have heard of this kind of sequel, and so it may well be of interest to people. I certainly hadn't heard of it, and I do tend to follow quite a lot of films out there. I can't really add a lot to what you've said, because I've not really ever read up on T.E. Lawrence, but one thing I can share is a personal anecdote, because when I first moved to Dorset, I say first, I only lived in Dorset on one six-year occasion. I believe it was about 6 years I spent there. But I moved to a town called Wareham in Dorset, which is where I understand Lawrence of Arabia lived, or T. Lawrence. And there was a pub there called the Black Bear, and it used to be a tea room. That was where T. Lawrence would actually go to on a regular basis, to the extent that where he used to sit was a little plaque saying this is where T. Lawrence used to sit when he came in here, that sort of thing, or Lawrence of Arabia, what have you. But I think the more interesting point is that I lived there for just under a year, and then moved to the next town over, which was more of a village called Beer Regis, and the road that linked Beer Regis to Wareham is a road that I travelled a great deal, because Wareham was the biggest town closest to Beer Regis, so that would be where you'd go to your supermarket and what have you, and that was also the road on which T. Lawrence was killed. And I can tell you, it's a very wide road. It seems very unlikely why someone would clip a motorcycle unless it was intentional. And I drove that road many times. It was a very pleasant drive because you had, like, fields either side, what have you, nice open country, big, nice wide road. A lot of roads in that area are very narrow, to the extent that if other cars are coming, you have to sort of slow down. They're little country roads. But this certainly isn't one of them. So I've always found it very surprising that such an accident could have happened there. But is there anything else that you'd like to add to that, Peter?
Well, it's when there's cover-ups, you get suspicious. And do you know, governments, their main function seems to be to accumulate documentation. And when information goes missing, you can be very suspicious. So the autopsy, the medical records, all these things of T. E. Lawrence have disappeared. And filmmakers have tried to find them, and they're all gone. They're missing. Just like about the Patton, General Patton murder, just is super suspicious when they've lost all the documentation. Just it's all gone somehow. That's amazing. But when they put restrictions and there's lies and there's cover-ups, you always know the government's got something very devious on the go. So why so much of the records of this have gone missing? And in fact, the inquest officer even said, now this is the morning of the funeral of T. E. Lawrence in Wareham, they actually were told they had to finish the inquest before the funeral, which was in the afternoon. So they had to wrap it up in the morning. All the testimonies, and this is one of the most famous people of the time, one of the great celebrities of the 20th century, and the inquest was so fast, and then the inquest officer actually instructed the jury they had to find. He told them before they went for the deliberations for accidental death. So he actually, I think it's illegal to actually tell the jury what they were meant to decide. So this was such a maneuvered operation, and we are told that the inquest officer was actually instructed by a high-level official that they had to find for accidental death before the funeral, which was coming up that afternoon. And by the way, Winston Churchill and Lady Astor traveled up to be at this memorial service, funeral service in Wareham, in the local church there. And T. E. Lawrence's grave is there. And interestingly enough, on his grave is the message in Latin, "The Lord is my light." And it's intriguing because, you know, you wouldn't get the impression from the Lawrence of Arabia film that Lawrence was a Christian. But in fact, when you look into his life, he was a Christian. He is a convinced Christian. Just because he is friendly to Muslims and respectful of them doesn't mean that he ever lost his Christian foundations. And yes, so on his gravestone at St. Nicholas's Church in Morton, in Dorset, is "Dominus Illuminatio Mea," "The Lord is my light," which, and that comes from John 5, verse 25, and from Psalm 27. So "The Lord is my light," that's on Lawrence's gravestone at St. Nicholas's Church. Very nice to know that he never lost his Christian faith, even while he was fluent in Arabic and immersed in Arabic culture. And what an amazing person, and so much good insights. And yet he, if his advice had been followed, we might not have any of these wars that are going on in the Middle East right now. He had a vision. He was an astounding person. You can see from his breadth of reading and research and history, as seen in the Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which is a phenomenal book. Seven Pillars of Wisdom came out in 1926. He later produced the book The Mint, which was very much suppressed because it was about his details of his service in the Royal Air Force. And it was seen as quite critical of the British government and of how they treated recruits. And so The Mint was just suppressed by the government. Isn't it amazing that such a famous celebrity, a national hero, can not only be censored but could then be even silenced in such a way. And that if you wonder how many other key people have had suspicious murders. And when I was looking into this about the murder of Lawrence of Arabia, comments were made about just like Princess Diana. And now I don't know that. I haven't gone down that rabbit hole. But interesting how many vehicle accidents happen to prominent people who could be an embarrassment for the powers that should not be. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Yes, certainly other examples of similar incidents such as Patton that you mentioned. But before we go, could you please let the audience know where they can find your work and how they can support you and how they can contact you?
Thank you so much, Andrew. Our website is www.frontlinemissionsa.org. Frontline Mission SA, short for South Africa. frontlinemissionsa.org. And my personal email, peter@frontline.org.za. peter@frontline.org.za. And we'd be so glad to hear from any of our listeners. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, so let's play the closing music. Here we go. I want to thank Peter so much for joining us today for a show entitled The Real Story Behind the Assassination of Lawrence of Arabia. Peter and I will be back with you again next Tuesday. I'll be back with you all for a bonus show tomorrow. And until then, folks, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day and bye for now.